Welcome everyone to this insight session on climate change, life insurance and retirement incomes. It's 12:30 and we have people also on the webinar. So hello to you guys at home or at work. So I'm very pleased to introduce today's session. We are going to have two speakers. Gillian Reid is going to talk to us first about investment in a time of climate change. Gillian is a principal in Mercer's responsible investment team. She advises super funds and other institutional investors on how to integrate environmental, social, and governance factors, sustainability trends, climate change, and stewardship within investment processes. Gillian contributes to new intellectual capital in integrating responsible investment within Mercer globally, including within the delegated solutions practice. Gillian was project manager and co-author for Mercer's 2015 Investing in a Time of Climate Change report. For those who know, that was a seminal report in the consideration of climate change, and also for the sequel this year in 2019. She's written and presented on water, too much water and too little water, and helped multiple boards to balance risk, return, and reputational impacts for sensitive investment topics. I'll actually do an intro to Ramona, who will speak afterwards. So Dr. Ramona Merrick is a director in Taylor Fry's Government, Health and Disability Practice. She's been an actuary for more than 15 years and brings her experience in data analytics, risk management to solve complex problems and improve social, health and economic outcomes for people and businesses. Previously, she's worked in a range of roles with a focus on financial and enterprise risk management for insurers, superannuation funds and pension providers. She's an active member of the Institute's Climate Change Working Group and an associate investigator at the UNSW Center of Excellence in Population Aging Research, CIPA. And by the way, my name is Sharanjit Padam. I am the convener of the Actuaries Institute's Climate Change Working Group. I'm sure you're going to be very inspired by today's presentation, so come and see me afterwards if you'd like to join our working group. We always have room for more members. This is a very active topic for us. But first of all, we'll have Gillian talk, as I said, about investment, and then Ramona will talk about our life and health. We'll then have time for Q&A at the end of that. Yes, okay, so I'll invite up Gillian. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharanjit. Thank you, everybody. What do you see? Has anyone seen this before? You're now starting to see it on billboards here, so it's a bit more familiar. These are the climate warming stripes, which represent the average global temperature increase of 1 degree that we've experienced between 1850 and 2017. It illustrates that 10 of the last 10 years have been 10 of the hottest in history and included 3 of the hottest ever. And this is why we're now having discussions about climate change, climate crisis, or climate emergency. So how on earth do we deal with this as investors? Mercer has been working on this for more than 10 years. Sharanjit mentioned the 2015 report that I was involved in, and then this was updated in the sequel in 2019. And our approach is really working with our asset owner clients, so across super funds, insurers, university endowments, etc., globally, looking at why is this important for investors? How do you approach this? How do we model this? What kind of return impacts might this be, and what do you do about it once you know this answer? So before we get into that, let's look at how do we go about this? How would you even approach this as investors? So scenario analysis is a common tool that you'll be familiar with as a way for considering possible outcomes and preparing for uncertainty. And it's particularly helpful for climate change, given there is no historical data to work with. This hasn't happened before. So we need to look in this forward-looking trajectory. So the way that we do that is to really break down what are the risk factors. So we've put them in four, essentially two parts. So the transition, what kind of investment do we need to transition to a low carbon economy and address the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing that temperature increase in the first place, and the technology and the policy environments that need to go with that. And we expect that's That's the first order impacts. That's what's happening right now. That's what needs to happen right now in order to avoid the physical damages impacts that are already starting now but will only get worse. And we break that down into two parts. So particularly the availability of natural resources, particularly water, and then looking at the impact of natural catastrophes. There are lots of different perils that can be modelled on that front. So looking at those risk factors and the numbers that we keep talking about when we're talking about scenarios is how those risk factors will play out until the end of the century. And depending on what we do on transition will depend on the physical damages we experience and whether we end up with a 2, 3, or 4 degree temperature increase by the end of the century. Now, most of those numbers don't necessarily mean a lot to a lot of people. What does 2 degrees even mean? This is the quick version. There is a lot more in the report that can't be explained here today. But this is a good way of summarising some of the milestones, both on the transition and then on the physical damages for each of the scenarios. If we start with where we are right now, fossil fuels are currently 80% of our energy mix. 80% of carbon emissions are not priced. There are about 6 million electric vehicles now, but that's still a really small percentage of the global fleet. We're already 1 degree hotter than we were from pre-industrial times. We've already had sea level rise about 20 centimetres, and we've already killed half of the Great Barrier Reef. The Mercer scenarios for our 2, 3, and 4 degree scenarios have the following milestones, and it's worth pointing out these are our scenarios, and I'll briefly summarise how we went about this, but there is no single scenario. There are different ways that you can put these scenarios together. And that's a whole other discussion. So in our 2 degree scenario, emissions need to peak next year, which will soon be really close, i.e. in a couple of months. So we might get to the end of next year, but it's very close. Our net zero is only at 2080. But this only gives us a 50% chance of hitting 2 degrees by the end of the century. If you want a 66% chance, or what we should be aiming for at 1.5 degrees, net zero needs to be 2050 or ideally a lot earlier. So even in our scenario, there's no coal by 2050, there's 50% new vehicle sales are electric. Even if we do that, we are still going to have temperature increases, we are still going to have 50 centimetres of sea level rise, we are still going to have higher daily temperatures and longer droughts. 3 degrees, you know, the emissions are flat, coal goes down a bit, but it's still 80% of our energy use. There's still some increase in electric vehicles, but there's not a big shift. So you start to get to the irreversible tipping points that is the great concern at the moment. So this is, you know, permafrost melting, etc. So you get these feedback loops, none of which are captured in the models, by the way. And that's when you start to get to 30% less water by the end of the century. But it's also worth pointing out that if we're on a 3 degree trajectory, we hit 2 degrees in 30 years. And that is outside the realm of human experience. In 150,000 years, humans have never lived in that temperature. That will happen in all of our lifetimes. 4 degrees has not happened for tens of millions of years and is a whole other world. And we start to talk about 50% less water. And obviously the hurricane impacts and all of the other things that cannot be modelled given the kind of extremes that we're talking about. So I appreciate that we've been avoiding talking about this for many decades, but I'm going to ask you now, what do you think? What do you think is the most likely scenario to eventuate at the moment? Now, I'm sorry to people on the webinar, we're not going to get your engagement, but the room will represent you. Hands up. Who thinks we're on track for 2 degrees? Few optimistic people. Who thinks we're on track for 3? Lots of people have done their homework. Anyone pessimistic about 4? Many pessimists in the room as well. This is just one example of how we can track this. This is the Climate Action Tracker. This is really looking just at the policy side and what the policy commitments look like. Based on the current policy commitments, we are on track for 3.3. That is if the Paris Agreement commitments are actually implemented. So, as Paul Gilding, a long-term climate advocate, says, if you don't despair, you're not paying attention. But don't stay there. So let's focus on what we can do about that, particularly as investors. I'm now going to give you the very quick version on how we have gone about this and some examples of the kind of modelling we can do for our investment clients. In order to create the scenarios, the risk factors, understand what ultimately the impact on return is, we actually used a group called Cambridge Econometrics in the UK as our base level work around transition. So they've done all the hard work about renewables and policy and when we think different countries are going to do different things that could put us on different trajectories, and some of the bottom-up work for the climate models. We used academic research on the physical side. We only looked at three perils, so coastal flooding, agriculture and wildfires, because it's very difficult to get the kind of granularity you need on the environmental work and the perils work to then be able to allocate it by asset classes and by sectors. So we've already recognised there are gaps in the environmental perils in this work. Not because we were lazy, because it's not there. So there's a lot of work that's gone underneath this. We've got information as far as sectors, regions, etc., in looking at the impacts on GDP and GVA. We then translated that into the investment impacts and broke it down into the scenario pathways and the sensitivities for different asset classes and different sectors so that we've got the flexibility. A, it was a calibration check. We weren't just taking what Cambridge gave us, but also we were able to then really break it down by all the different kinds of permutations that investors use. There is a lot more in the appendix of the report. There's quite a lot that we put out publicly about how we've gone about this. The whole report's available publicly. So the end result is we've got two ways that we can model this for clients. So we're looking at annual and cumulative impacts on return at a total portfolio, asset class and industry sector level across, we typically do three time frames, like 2030, 2050 and out to 2100. We know investors are not thinking about 2100, but it gives you the context of what we're trying to avoid that we need to do now. The second way is a stress testing approach, which is new in the work that we've done this year compared to 2015. And it's really recognising that it's unlikely this is going to be nice, neat annual impacts on return. It is more likely that we're going to get surprises. So what happens when there, if you capitalise those annual impacts and you look at what a shock might be, both changing the probability for the scenarios, but also this is where we can bring in the market awareness. So how well do you think this is priced right now? And different clients have different views on this and we can test different ways. The end result and some of the key findings in the public report is this work, and because we've gone out to 2100, it really brings in those physical damages. And this is really what justifies why a 2-degree scenario is in our best interests. That there are transition opportunities, so this is not all doom and gloom, particularly over the next 10 years. If we are going to achieve a 2-degree scenario, the changes to our economy must be transformative. And that this does pose really quite significant opportunities if we take them. The return impacts are still most visible at the sector level, not surprisingly, around energy and utilities and some asset classes, particularly infrastructure. You will get different results, positive or negative, depending on which scenario eventuates. And then finally, the stress testing. We think this has been a very helpful way for clients to look at this. So a couple of examples of the kind of analysis that we're looking at. So when we look at the physical damages, let's look at the comparison between a 2, 3, and 4-degree scenario at 2030 and at 2050 for a diversified portfolio. And we've run many, many portfolios now for clients in multiple regions around the world, and you will get different results for different portfolio outcomes, or different portfolios, sorry. But as a general rule, this is the kind of trends that we're seeing across multiple portfolios. They're not enormous numbers when you look at it on an annual basis, but I'll show you some cumulative and stress testing impacts in a moment. The transition opportunities are another great example where if you actually change, particularly your equities exposures, your infrastructure exposures, to the opportunistic side, so looking at the sustainability solutions, there are some really quite significant positive differences that can happen in a 2-degree scenario, but the downside change is really small. So if 3 or 4 plays out, there isn't a lot of downside for going for those opportunities if we can. And that's a really important part. There's a whole other paper we did a couple of years ago about the low carbon transition premium, and there's some more analysis that sits behind that. As I mentioned, we do also look at the cumulative impacts, and this example portfolio shows you that there is some benefits. So in a 2-degree scenario of the first 10 years, this portfolio will have a 1% better outcome on a cumulative basis than it will if the other scenarios eventuate. But by the time you get to 2050, it's not well positioned for 2 degrees. It's not very well aligned for a 2-degree scenario. And by the end of the time, 4 degrees is certainly the worst outcome. But it's important to note by 2050 that in any of the scenarios, this portfolio can expect to lose between 5 and 8%. And it's also important to consider this is uncompensated risk. It's like operations risk. This is not, I'm going to take a risk here because I think there's going to be return upside on the other side. It's not this kind of, it's different to the other scenarios that you would think about. It's really a direction of travel, and we're really just arguing about how quickly that happens. It's when you go underneath different, that's all an aggregate diversified portfolio level. You then come underneath and you'll get very different results depending on what the asset class exposures are, particularly in infrastructure, particularly because of renewables. The fundamentals around all of this is that we are changing the energy that underpins our entire economy. That's what we need to do. So some really substantial changes need to happen around infrastructure, and there's upside to that in a 2-degree scenario. But again, you start to see in infrastructure, property, agriculture, others, you'll get some negative downsides in the others because the physical damages start to play out in those higher temperature scenarios. But again, you'll get different results depending on what your mix is, particularly energy, utilities, materials. There are particular sectors that, not surprisingly, they're the first order impacts that will really change what your results look like. You'll also get different results depending on your regional exposures, so particularly around the physical damages and what you're exposed to there. So we can go down to each of these levels. Everything here we're talking about is a very top-down approach. And finally, an example on the stress testing. So this is where the impacts that we're talking about here are not annual impacts on return. They're really less than 1-year impacts. So they're at a point in time when you've got a change in probability and a change in market awareness. And for this portfolio, for an example, the total portfolio is at minus 2%. So it's an additional 2% of lost return in the space of a year if there is a sudden shift to a 2-degree scenario, and this portfolio is just not very well positioned for that. There are other portfolios that are positively positioned, and as an example, we've done some changing here to increase the sustainability-themed exposure, and that can start to mitigate and start to improve the portfolio outcome in this stress test. So of all the different portfolios that we run, the stress tests, and we do them moving to 2 degrees, moving to 4 degrees, you can test different levels of market awareness. But the point is that when you start to do that, when you start to do the more sudden impact, you can be anywhere between -2, -3%, +2, +3% within the space of a year. So it's not these gradual impacts anymore. So what do we do with these numbers? How are we applying these? Essentially, we're approaching climate change as we approach all other ESG topics with our asset owners, and it starts with governance. So it is about how do you incorporate climate change as an explicit consideration, given the systemic nature of the issue. It's across the whole portfolio, it's multiple decades. It can't just be delegated to your managers. Asset owners need to pay attention to this and take this on right up to a board level. There really needs to be ownership of this right throughout the whole investment process, because if you can get agreement and an understanding by decision makers of all of these issues, it's documented in beliefs, in policies, in processes, it makes the portfolio decisions really easy. That was a bold statement. Nothing's really easy. Easier, much easier. And then there's really four approaches that we take when it comes to portfolio implementation. So integration, so just integrating the risk return considerations alongside everything else that you would think about. Engaging, so this is about voting, engaging the companies, engaging the policymakers to help to influence the environment we're working in. The investment piece, so actually investing in those solutions, actually allocating on the positive side and looking for those opportunities. And then screening is the fourth one, which says if you don't think, from a financial point of view, if you don't think the integration and the engagement and the investment is enough and you don't have the managers that can manage it in those ways, you might need to set some restrictions, particularly around the highest carbon assets. So this integration piece, this climate scenario analysis, and you can then obviously augment that with lots of bottom-up metrics, is really helping to inform all of the other parts of the investment process. And then importantly, these days, we now need to tell people that we're doing this. So this focus on disclosure and the task force on climate-related financial disclosures and the recommendations that they released now 2.5 years ago. And these are the recommendations for companies, for asset managers, asset owners globally. Now, they're voluntary, but increasingly you are seeing this adopted as best practice. This is the standard that CDP is using for company disclosure, that PRI is using for investor disclosure. Regulators are starting to use, particularly in Europe, as this is the standard. Now, we don't have that here yet, but even our regulators are actually finally making the right noises. So we have finally, just in recent weeks, put our TCFD disclosure statement up for Mercer's Australian funds. And there are lots of examples now. In fact, when I leave you, I'm about to go to an IGCC session on TCFD disclosure as we all work through how do we explain to our stakeholders that we are managing climate change risks. And to finish up, I'm going to leave you with another couple of pieces that aren't in the model. The social reaction to what is happening is not modelled. Both the push by civil society for change and pushing our governments to finally act is not captured in the model. Other social implications are not captured in the model. So when we get to 30% less water or 50% less water and people start to move, that's not captured in the model. So it's important to remember all the things that we can model. But I do also highly recommend that you actually read the report and lots of the other reports that are out there that help us think what's not in the model. And if all of the brains in this room could help us work out how to do that, that would be much appreciated. So that social license to operate issues are not in the model. The litigation's not in the model yet either. This is the non-US one. There's a whole site that's capturing all of these. The US one doesn't fit on a slide. It's something to worth remembering. So, I'm sorry if I have depressed you. There is not enough time to go through all of the other positive stories that come with this, but it's important to give you that perspective and for you to remember these climate warming stripes and the many reasons this is important as investors. And then, apart from joining Sharanjit's working group and reading the Mercer report, you need to think about what before you do. Thanks. I'll pass to Ramona.
Thanks, Gillian, for a great talk. So Gillian's just spoken extensively about the risks from an investor perspective, and I'm going to move on in the second half will be about the risk more holistically for life insurers and superannuation funds, incorporating elements other than the investment risk. So I'm going to start by discussing a framework in which life insurers and superannuation funds can think about climate risk. then I'm going to focus on climate risk for life insurers first and fill in a few of the missing pieces that are additional to investment risk. And they are mainly, what is climate change going to do to mortality and the health of the people who are the customers of life insurers and superannuation funds? And after looking at the physical risk to life and health, I'm going to move on in the final section and look at some scenario modelling around retirement incomes. So taking those in potential impacts Gillian's been talking about and saying, what does that mean for accumulated superannuation and for the incomes we'll retire with? So the key focus for us as actuaries is there likely, as a consequence of climate change, to be material financial impacts for the organisations that we work for? There's extensive literature discussing all the scientific elements, but the actuarial question is, for the organisations we work for, what are the financial risks that are going to bear out? So the framework I find most helpful for thinking about this is taken from the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. And there are three main buckets that climate risk gets grouped under. So physical risk, Gillian spoke to the risk of physical damage resulting from heat waves and natural disasters. Those underlying risks are the same. It's just the channels by which they influence life and health are a bit different, but the risks themselves are the same. The second category, transition risk, is what's going to happen in the shift to a low carbon economy. That has wide-ranging impacts for employment, for investment returns. And the third category is liability risk, and that really goes to the last slide from Gillian's presentation, which is the litigation. The fact that individuals and companies may be sued for failure to assess, failure to act on information, or failure to disclose how climate risk impacts their customers. So focusing first on a life insurer, one point I wanted to make when you kind of flesh this picture out is that it's important not to view these risks in isolation of one another. They interact, and in many cases, multiple risk factors or drivers will impact a life insurance balance sheet at the same time. So if you take an example of a widespread natural disaster, that has consequences for economic activity in affected regions. At the same time that your claims might be getting hit, if you take the Victorian 2009, January 2009 Black Saturday bushfires were accompanied by a week-long heat wave that resulted in 370 additional deaths. So at the same time that we're seeing widespread impacts that may influence claims, you're also going to have economic disruption and social disruption, and that can manifest in many ways, which are very hard to model. But the interactions are important and the compounding of risk. So in many senses, it's about asking yourself as a life insurer or as a superannuation fund specific questions to drill down into the detail of what these kind of headlines might mean for your fund. So in terms of physical risk and potentially, I'll talk more to this as we go through the slides, but it's really important to look at the age and the geographic distribution of exposure in your life insurance portfolios. And to just flick forward, when we talk about heat-related mortality, 80% of heat-related mortality is typically in those aged 65 or older. I'll talk later to why that is. So that's just an example of why the age distribution of exposures is important. Geographic distribution is also important. Climate's not a broad thing the climate in the north of Australia is intrinsically different to the south of Australia, and the climate risks, the physical risks of specific natural disasters, cyclones are more prevalent in the north, heat and extreme heat is more common in the north. I'm going to move on. The last point I want to make on this slide is on liability risk, and that is the way that life insurers can best monitor what's going on in this space is by looking at the cases going through court. So currently, to date, REST and CBA have both been sued for failure to adequately disclose climate risks for their investment. The case with REST is currently in the federal court. So that's the best way to understand how you're exposed, but it, based on the very limited case evidence, it seems failure to disclose is the core risk there. So I want to put some meat around what the physical risks for life insurers are, and specifically what these risks are in Australia for Australian life insurers. Globally, there are three main drivers of that climate change will have on health, and they are severe weather-related events, so health impacts from natural disasters, heat-related mortality and morbidity, and infectious illness and vector-borne disease. In Australia, we don't have high levels of vector-borne disease transmitted by mosquitoes. So in Australia, the primary driver of health and mortality impacts that climate change will have is heat waves and extreme heat. Heat waves have killed more Australians than any other natural disaster combined to date. And I'm now going to spend the next couple of slides talking in more detail to some of these health impacts that are really going to be the way that climate change influences the claims experience of life and health insurers. So the case study of Victoria's record-breaking heatwave in January 2009 is a really salient one. 374 deaths in excess of what was experienced in that period the preceding year. 80% of those deaths in the elderly. And I'd like to talk to that experience a bit more. That doesn't, because the number 374 doesn't capture the full extent of the health risk and pressures on the system. So the morgues were overflowing in Victoria during that week. The ambulance call-outs hit record-breaking levels, and not all calls could be responded to. Emergency department attendances for respiratory illness, heart attack, stroke, were at record levels. So boiling it down into a number of deaths doesn't do justice to the full range of health impacts from extreme heat. Another important point here is that the way that we derive mortality estimates is inherently uncertain, because when insurers capture data about a claim, or when a presentation at hospital, someone's admitted to hospital for an illness or an emergency, what gets recorded is a primary diagnosis. So that the diagnosis that we capture in our claims data or in hospital and health data is usually heart attack, stroke, asthma exacerbation. Very infrequently are the actual environmental contributors or climate contributors captured, and the one exception is if someone's burnt in a bushfire, then there's a direct link in the data. But this lack of concrete data, particularly over time, means there are high levels of uncertainty in predicting what the long-term impacts are going to be from heat waves on mortality and heat-related illness. The physical risks, on the other hand, are very clear. Over the duration of the 20th century, there was a clear increase in the number and the duration of heat waves. the scientific climate models projecting that forward over the 21st century is set to worsen even further, such that all Australian capital cities are expected to experience a tripling of heatwave days by the year 2080. It's a long-range forecast, but just to put into context what that means, Darwin at the moment experiences about 28 days of extreme heat a year. A tripling by 2080, they're projected to experience almost 4 months. So summer will be consistently above 38 back to back. And those impacts will vary across. They'll be worse in the north than the south of Australia. However, there's consistency that this is going to be an increasing problem and agreement it will lead to more heat-related mortality. The dialogue paper does go into the numbers a bit more, and being actuaries, I'm sure we all want to wrap this up in an impact on a mortality rate. That doesn't really do justice to the problem, because any numbers produced projecting forward what the mortality impacts might be are done on an all else being equal basis. So they're assuming society doesn't change and respond. If we do that, we can see the mortality rate increasing on heatwave days by up to 12% for those over 65. So it's an impressive number, but many factors will affect the actual mortality implications between now and 2080. And they are the size of our population, the geographic distribution, its age distribution, building standards. So the buildings that we sleep in, that we live and work in, are they thermally insulated, or are we not able to sleep for consecutive days? Loss of sleep during heatwaves periods has been correlated with increased workplace accidents. So that's just one example of this interaction and compounding of effects and how complicated it is to model and project these impacts out into the future, because there are so many social dependencies that will affect what ultimate mortality is, but it's going to be problematic. A second category of physical risk, which is, it would be amiss not to mention today, is air quality. Climate change is forecast to worsen air quality in Australia by two main channels. The two main pollutants affecting health are ozone and particulate matter. Ozone production increases in warmer weather. It's scientifically established that higher levels of ozone will be present in the air in the future. One study tried to put a number to that on an all else being equal basis under a 2-degree warming scenario, and said that in Sydney alone, the increase in ozone concentrations could cause 60 deaths per annum. For those who want a number, it could be much greater. It could potentially be less. In addition to ozone, today what we're seeing is an increase in particulate matter because of bushfires. Last week, the air quality in Port Macquarie was the worst in the world. There's a real-time air quality index tracker there. Today, the air quality is worse in Sydney than it is in Beijing. And the science says that bushfires and bushfire risk will become more intense and more frequent in the future. This is likely to lead to deteriorating air quality. The World Health Organization estimates that globally, air quality shaves around a year off the life expectancy of those living in the UK, and globally it's responsible for around 8 million premature deaths. So that number 60 there doesn't do it justice, because in addition to deaths, which probably aren't tracked, because if you go into the data they will appear as lung cancer, respiratory illness, for example. In addition to the death, we also have a strain on the health system from increased hospital admissions for asthma and respiratory illness, and the long-term effects are not well understood and are inherently difficult to model, but the risk needs to be borne in mind. And the final category of physical risks pertinent to climate change is mental health. It's long been established that there's a link between drought and poor mental health of those living in remote and regional communities. Climate change will mean that droughts last for longer and are more frequent. A second mental health channel is those surviving natural disasters. So after the Victorian 2009 bushfires, a longitudinal study was put in place monitoring the ongoing impacts of people who lived through those fires and who lived through a low level of effect and up to a high and severe level of effect. The study is still going, and 10 years on, the impacts are continuing to be felt by many of the participants in that study. However, the long-term experience is not well understood, and as social attitudes and the social mediation of mental health changes over time, there are likely to be interactions here. The Lancet Countdown report is a global study of the impacts that climate change will have on health and mortality. And they've pulled out that there are mental health effects through both natural disaster and extreme heat channels. And however, they're highly socially and culturally mediated. The experience and awareness of mental health in a country like Australia has been topical for a large time. And so one would only think that we're not a country that will shy away and bottle up the experience and mental health outcomes of these effects into the future. However, quantifying these effects is problematic because of a lack of data that's of clear importance. That ends the section of the talk that talks to the physical risks, and really they're the most pertinent for life insurers and life insurance claims. And the next and final section I'm going to speak to is impact for superannuation fund members and on retirement incomes. So when we talk about superannuation, the transition risks, and particularly the return risks that Gillian spoke to, are of primary importance. And the extension or the contribution that the dialogue paper makes on top of the excellent work done by Mercer is to say what that means for individual, what that might mean under two scenarios for individual Australians in terms of the dollars super they'll retire with and the dollars they'll have to live on each year in retirement. In addition to return risks, the second category of risks we call out as being of primary importance to when you think about superannuation saving are risk to income. Under the superannuation guarantee, superannuation savings are basically a percentage of your lifetime income compounded. So there are two channels we're calling out in the paper by which climate change could reduce lifetime income. And the first of those is transition risks, but as the transition of the economy shifts to one of low carbon intensity, specific industries are likely to see drops in employment. So we saw this when the Hazelwood thermal coal mine closed in the Latrobe Valley. The unemployment rate jumped from around 5.6% to 8% and remained at 8% for 2 years. Those people had to find alternative jobs, and actually the unemployment rate has dropped back down now to its long-term level after 2 years. They've found work in health, agriculture, tourism. But those are the types of risks. For those people having to transition work or losing a job because of this economic transition means a period of lost earnings. And the second risk is as a response to natural disasters. In the general insurance debate around climate change. There's a lot of work and discussion around affordability of insurance premiums out into the future. And one of the potential consequences there is levels of underinsurance increasing. Even in the absence of that, there is an underinsurance problem. And so to the extent that individuals are underinsured following a natural disaster, business disruption's worse, which can have employment impacts. And in addition, if they have to divert personal savings to repair or rebuild property, there are impacts there. So, as has been touched on a number of points throughout this talk, these impacts are highly uncertain. There's limited data to say what the future will look like in some kind of concrete manner. So the modelling approach we took was scenario modelling, consistent with the recommendations under TCFD. And we modelled two scenarios, which arguably are worst case or conservative scenarios. Scenario one models a loss of employment income, one in every 10 years for a worker. The modelling's done at an individual level. Scenario two captures the investment return risks and models a 1 percentage point reduction in the return rate, assuming someone's invested in a balanced portfolio. So the way we arrived at 1 percentage point was the sector-specific weights in the Mercer 2019 report can be weighted by the ASX market capitalisation at present. Because of Australia's large energy sector, the weighting you'll get there is 70 basis point negative return out to 2050 per annum for someone who was invested in line with ASX market capitalisation under a 2-degree scenario. They were the Mercer report also notes that sovereign risk is a issue, particularly in Australia, and that can be evidenced by the Reserve Bank of Sweden has just sold its Australian government bonds, citing a huge regulatory or policy risk around complete inaction on climate change. So in a balanced portfolio, you've got, was it 60-40? So it's ballpark a feasible, potentially worst case scenario. So the first thing we did was just project out superannuation accumulations. And we did that for the median earner. You can do this using the ASIC superannuation projection tool. If you select the assumptions, our baseline for a median earner, the current median household income is $75,000. The ASIC recommendation for investment returns is 4.8%. And the full set of assumptions are taken from the ASIC calculator. So we're modelling an individual through their working life. So this is potentially what the future looks like for somebody just entering the workforce. So on a baseline scenario, someone invested in a balanced portfolio starting out on the median household income would accumulate $382,000 by age 67 in today's dollar terms. In scenario one, which is a 10% drop in lifetime earnings roughly, that accumulated superannuation balance would drop by 11%. But the greater impact comes from the return impacts. So these are done in isolation. So assuming no change to earnings, but a 1% drop in returns, they would retire with 18% less accumulated super at age 67. So the bigger picture is what that actually means for retirement incomes, because life continues beyond age 67, and that accumulated super is used to fund an income that needs to see us through to death. So there's a lot going on in this graph, and I want to explain it because it's really the crux of the retirement modelling. On the horizontal axis, this is the percentile of the full-time earnings distribution that you sit at. So the 50th percentile is the median household earning $75,000 per annum at the moment. The red solid line, is our base scenario. So that's the total retirement income an individual receives. In Australia, we have a means-tested age pension. So in Australia, the total income you retire with is the sum of what you can fund from your accumulated superannuation balance plus what you are entitled to after age pension means testing, which is a function of your income and wealth. And that's why we've modelled at each point on the full-time earnings distribution. So the black line is the age pension, and you can see that approaching zero at for the highest earners. They have, in this model, they have a small amount of age pension entitlement, because the assumption in the modelling is that from age 67 to age 92, there's full drawdown of your accumulated superannuation balance. So even the richest in society achieve an entitlement to the government age pension at the end of their lives. It's a stylized scenario. The main point to take from the graph here is that the age pension is acting as a hedge. So for the median earner we spoke about, the red line drops about $900. So at the 50th percentile in the middle of the graph, we see that the average annual retirement income drops from $35,000 per annum to $34,000. But what the total masks is that your self-funded retirement income drops by more. That drops by, say, $2,000. And you can see the larger gap on the green line. But because you have a lower accumulated balance, your age pension entitlement increases. So that means, in a nutshell, Australians will retire with less, but not be as worse off as if we didn't have an age pension. That age pension will be funded by the government. And under both of these scenarios, we see an increase in the cost to government of the age pension. So scenario two models a 1 percentage point reduction in return. And the key call outs here is looking at that median earner again. Their retirement incomes will drop by 5%, which is a lot less than the 18% reduction in their accumulated superannuation balance due to a large offset from increased entitlement to the government age pension. Overall, however, their retirement income will be $2,000 a year worse off. So just to illustrate the dynamics, what we've gone through is how climate change can affect the claims risk for life insurers. We've gone through the size of the potential impacts on the numbers in terms of superannuation accumulation balances and retirement incomes. And we've done all that in a very superficial way. They're stylized scenarios, and each impact has been taken individually. So scenario one just looks at income risks. Scenario two just looks at investment risks. Both have costs to individuals, cost to the government, cost to society at large, therefore. And these costs are likely to compound. So in reality, what's likely to play out for some Australians is a combination of some return shocks, potentially some health shocks, potentially some earnings shocks, and these all need to be considered together from the perspective of your own individual businesses. And I hope that today's talk has helped you start that process and given you some frameworks and tools for thinking about this ginormous problem.
I invite you up, and perhaps we can open up for questions. We'll start over here. So for your questions, if you could just wait for the mic to come to you so that the people at home can hear, and perhaps give you intro your name.
My name is Chris Wildman. I'm from Robeco Investment Management. Question for Gillian. Are you aware of any investment managers or maybe even your clients who are actually investing for that 2-degree scenario? Like, I know that there are people who are obviously investing particularly towards things like SDGs at the moment, and they have environmentally sensitive or environmentally focused portfolios, but actually anyone that said we're investing towards a 2-degree scenario right now?
It's mainly in Europe, so the Environment Agency Pension Fund, Church of England, some of the Nordics clients, etc., they've already taken that position. There are also a group of our clients who've worked with us on the scenario analysis who are part of our Future Makers group. So we use the term Future Maker as a group that rather than just taking whatever scenario might eventuate and preparing for that, actually looking to influence the portfolio that the scenario that eventuates. So that group, together with, there's now a working group happening in Europe with the institutional investor group on climate change over there. It's an active discussion here to actually now start saying, what does that look like? How do I actually, so it's part of the TCFD already, in the metrics and targets bit, the target setting part. So Mercer's put up our report. It just says, we're working on the targets. We haven't done that bit yet. And the target setting is, it's difficult, particularly when you're doing that at an aggregate portfolio, you're looking across all the different, you know, carbon budgets and carbon transitions across all of the different sectors and all of the different asset classes, and what is my market share of that? It's difficult to do, but it's not to say it's not possible. So there is definitely an active focus now to say, if I'm going to be a future maker and really influence that 2-degree scenario, and everyone's got different views about how you do that within fiduciary duty and how you, how far do you go in doing that, but absolutely that is a new focus that you will hear lots of discussions about Paris alignment, net zero targets, future making portfolios.
Thanks. Any more questions? Sure. Just wait for the mic. Thank you.
Martin Considine from Challenger. Gillian, another question for you. You asked the audience whether we believe the 2, 3, or 4. I would love to hear your views.
I was more optimistic the 4 years I was living in London before I moved back here. So it's one of those, working in this space, I've been doing this 5 years now. A lot of people have been working on this for a lot longer than me. That there is this real tension between being realistic about the science and where we're up to, and there's a really significant challenge that we're facing. There are some really significant changes that need to happen in how we operate to pull this off. And the window is absolutely closing. However, I also believe, and Paul Gilding says this too, we're slow, we're not stupid. That I do believe that there is a much greater awareness now, the actions being taken, and that if you watch a documentary like 2040, that's your positive action for the day, by the way, so you don't all come away totally depressed. That given the technology we have right now, if we do that, it's all possible. So we are still going to face physical damages, but we do have technologies available to help us adapt and it's not technology, it's not even capital requirements, it is literally political will. So that's up to us. I became more pessimistic after the results of our last election. It's going to be very important to see what happens in the next 12 months before there's a meeting in the next month or so, the Conference of the Parties on Climate Change globally, but the 2020 meeting next year, and the US election will have happened just before that meeting, is going to be a critical milestone. I'll tell you after that.
Another question? Sure, just wait for a mic. Thanks, Sarah.
Hi, my name's Alex from Future Super. My question's for Ramona. Aside from actually understanding the mortality risks that climate change poses to insurers, what actions can insurers take to mitigate their exposure to that risk at a corporate investor level?
So in a sense, there's some natural mitigation built in because, as I talk to, the risks are greatest for the elderly, and currently most insurance contracts in Australia taper off. So income protection ends at age 65 in most contracts. Critical illness and TPD benefits taper off at age 65. There is remaining mortality risk exposure. I think people still need the protection, so some of the suggestions in the paper are to raise customer awareness. There's an increasing focus on wellness in the life and health insurance industry, and part of wellness is just understanding the importance of hydration, staying out of poor air quality, living in a thermally efficient home that allows you to get good night's sleep. If you're facing a situation where heat waves are going for weeks at a time, that understanding of importance of sleep. So I think that insurers, life and health insurers, are part of that, should be part of that conversation with their customers.
And just to add to that, what about at the level of being a large financial institution? How can they use that to mitigate their climate risk?
I think, Gillian, you're probably better placed to talk to that one.
It is all the actions that I talked about. So it is that governance piece, it's the integration piece. It is climate change, the transition side, the physical damages side, is it actually part of all of the decisions that happen already? So it's not some separate project it might need to be to start with, but then it really should be embedded in all of those decisions. And it is a different way of thinking because you can't just rely on everything that's happened before. You need to look forward. And there is that consideration about, you know, your business risk, your stakeholders, your role to be played in this. But yeah, I think it's all of those. It's the governance piece, but it is that integration, the engagement, the investment, the screening. It is all of those tools. I mean, it really needs all of those tools being used by everyone to make this happen.
I mean, if I can just chip in from a sort of general insurer point of view, and I realise we're not on the billing here, but I think for us, what we're doing is trying to understand what the future looks like and what the resilience of our business is to these kinds of outcomes and these particular scenarios. And the important thing here is that the base scenario, the kind of scenario where we're ending up, is not life as it is today. It's not the current returns. It's not the current natural disasters. It is the 4 degrees or the 3.3 degree scenario that we're currently tracking towards. And just doing that kind of scenario analysis and trying to understand what that means for very basic, what that means for your claims, what that means for your pricing, what that means for your capital requirements, what that means for your investment strategy, what that means for the types of products you sell to your customers. I definitely agree with Gillian that you actually have to think through this whole through on how it affects the different parts of the operation of your business and how that will change. And I think institutions are gradually working this out and figuring out what this means, and at the same time figuring out their strategies that they will deploy in order to mitigate those scenarios and in order to develop them there. What you'll find is, what I believe you'll find is that it's very different outcomes from a 2-degree scenario to what a 4-degree scenario is, and how you have to alter your strategy to cope with that and build resilience into how you survive as an organization.
Because it is consistent with the TCFD, and because it is for companies, asset owners, asset managers, and obviously I'm working more on the investment side, but you've had to think through the whole business side. That's why the TCFD recommendations, they're not prescriptive, it is a framework. Because the business risk is going to be really quite different for all the different businesses, depending on their location and all. So the actual, you've got to really think it through for your own particular company and your own particular organisation, using that framework as a guide, because you will get quite different outcomes.
I have a question here from the people on the webinar. It's actually for you again, Gillian. So how do we gauge which scenarios are being priced in at the moment in a market? And I understand you did some of that within your analysis.
So this is one that we didn't touch at all in 2015. We've tried to have a go at that, or at least give our clients a way to think about this this year. And we did decide we had to come up with a number, because our clients will say, well, what do you think as a starting point? So the number we've gone with as a starting point is 20%. Now, that's not an exact science. It's based on discussions with fund managers and who's doing what. And you could certainly think that there's been a shift from our 2015 report to now. So I think the coal discussion is, you would say that anyone who's not paying attention to that is really not paying attention. But lots of other asset classes, lots of other particular sectors, like apart from those really obvious first order impacts, is it being priced in? I don't think so. And if you look at the, and you could also use the fact that 80% of carbon emissions, there's a World Bank site that tracks carbon pricing by country, that 80% of them at the moment aren't priced. So that's a couple of metrics we've used as a guide, but open to other feedback on that.
Yep. I think one, there's two interesting viewpoints on this from the UK. So the first one is, if you look at what the stress tests that the Prudential Regulatory Authority is requiring general insurers and banks to do, they talk about the concept of this Minsky moment, where you get a sudden pricing in of climate into the markets, resulting in sudden asset shocks, which is the policymaker disaster scenario, particularly if you're a regulator. What you'd much rather see is a slow transition over time as people pull out and you get less incidence of stranded assets and that kind of exposure. So certainly the regulators, their prime concern, if you listen to what they talk about, is a Minsky moment and a sudden pricing in of this risk. And I think the other one to talk about is Mark Carney, who's the chair of the Bank of England, and he talks about the tragedy of the horizons affecting kind of decision making on this, because if we think a lot of how the asset management industry works, it's very much driven by short-term returns. By short-term, we mean 1 to 2 years. Certainly that's how analysts are viewed, and certainly that's, everybody looks at the annual returns. And so there's a real danger that you go along that track, and in the long term, you hit this disastrous outcome because you've been following this annual step-by-step process. And part of the challenge that the Prudential Regulation Authority is throwing out to industry is, how do you make rational short-term decisions with the long-term decision in mind? Now, hopefully that's a very actuarial question, and people can kind of get that, get their heads around that there is a trajectory. If we keep just going step by step by step, we're going to fall off the cliff, and that somehow we've got to start to think about this longer-term problem. And I think that speaks to some of the pricing issues. Sorry.
Hi, Gillian. This one's for you. So you mentioned fiduciary duty a little bit earlier. How do you think super fund trustees can manage the balance between investing responsibly and essentially going for an unconstrained portfolio?
So while it's not as clear in our environment at the moment, there are some changes that I would like to make in the guidance provided to our trustees here. It is very clear in lots of other legal documents and in lots of other regulatory requirements in Europe, and it is becoming increasingly clearer here that it is a failure of fiduciary duty not to take these climate change risk and return considerations into account. It is absolutely consistent with fiduciary duty. But assessing the risks and thinking about integration, thinking about engagement, that's easy. And there's lots of examples about what can be done, you know, reducing equity benchmark portfolios, you know, reducing carbon intensity is very easy to do in a passive equity exposure and certainly in active thematic funds. And there's lots of examples where you can absolutely do that. You're not affecting your risk return objective at all. In fact, it's a risk mitigator. It's when you come to the solution side that it's being slower for people to really go, oh, there is actually lots of new products available and there's lots of proven options to invest in good opportunities here. That's been slower, but we certainly think there's a big return opportunity there across lots of asset classes, lots of parts of the value chain. It's not just renewables. There's all the property discussions. You know, the first passive houses are finally in Australia, and there's lots of amazing opportunities to be looked at. It's the screening parts, that fourth part, about what are you excluding is where you can get into discussions about is that consistent with fiduciary duty, depending on how far you go. There are lots of, you know, the ethics and the financial discussion, particularly around thermal coal and tar sands, and that's pretty much come together. It's not a decision really. But it's how far you go down that transition path. So, and there will certainly be different views. And back to your point, Chris, about the 2-degree alignment and the influencing outcome, how far do you want to go? And you can have big arguments about divestment versus engagement. And so there's certainly some space to have discussion about different approaches in there. But there are lots of ways to do this that are very consistent, in fact, required for fiduciary duty.
Perhaps I can put a question. Ramona, do you have any thoughts about what health insurers should be thinking about, private health insurers at the moment, around these issues?
They've got quite a lot on their plate.
Yes.
Maybe shorter term existential risks. But certainly the direction of the risk is clear. I mean, climate change isn't going to lead to better health outcomes for people in Australia. There was a long time ago some misinformation out that potentially there'll be offsets in those people who die in extreme cold. There'll be less of those deaths. But at both a global level and certainly at an Australian level, climate change will lead to more deaths in Australia and more illness. So,
did the Australian Medical Association come out with something recently as well that was quite specific on climate change? So,
yes, asking for it to be, I guess, declared as a health emergency or health crisis.
They declared it as a climate emergency. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just both to the life and health space, you can't manage what you don't measure. And currently, there's an adequate capture of environmental factors contributing to illness and inadequate long-term study of the mental health impacts and the physical health impacts. So any contributions in that space, research or improvement in data capture, or experience sharing would be a major step forward.
Yeah. Is it last year or earlier this year, the Queensland Health Department came up with an estimate of what climate change would cost them. And there were some pretty scary numbers in that report, which is well worth thinking of as well. So while everybody else thinks of another question, I just put one in here for you, Gillian. What are the opportunities coming out of this? Because we've talked about how superannuation funds and life insurers and health insurers can think about the risks. But what about the opportunities? What are emerging in terms of products, in terms of what we're seeing for managers, basically?
So there's a lot happening in this space and across asset classes. So, and I do encourage you to think about the whole value chain. So in a private market space, so particularly on infrastructure, on renewables, that's your obvious starting point. but yeah, think through the value chain about all of the different companies that are providing all the different parts that go and all the servicing and all the different elements that come with those. And obviously batteries is, you know, there's a race to the top happening at the moment on batteries and all the different ways that we can help avoiding creating new issues with rare earths when it comes to batteries and waste, etc. So that the energy piece is certainly key. But then when you look at the built environment more generally, you know, what are we doing on steel, on concrete, on, you know, there's lots of the industrial sectors that are transitioning. Because last week there was new developments on steel, and so there's lots of different, and certainly the passive house piece, the tech piece that comes with all of the built environment developments. So there is lots to happen in our building industry. So not just big infrastructure, but certainly within the property space. We've done very well so far on the office space, commercial space, but there is a long way to go on shopping centres, on industrials, on aged care, on schools, on... how, you know, so the whole property sector and all the different parts in that value chain, and that's before we get into water. Yes, all the infrastructure around water and what can we do on water recycling and grey water and all of those kind of issues. And then we get to pollution and testing and waste and circular economy and recycling and all the things to avoid landfills. So there are lots of different options to be considered, and there are certainly managers coming to us who are very well-established managers, who have, you know, very well-rated, regarded products across the listed equity space, but even looking at credit space, right through to obviously all of the private market options. So there's, you know, the space will continue to grow, but if you don't have any of that right now, time to move.
Hi, Amanda Keogh, and thank you all for a really insightful presentation. What struck me the most in the presentation, and look, I'm not an expert here, but was the disconnect between what the scenarios depict in terms of even 2-degree warming up to 4-degree warming, and then the impact on the amount of money that someone making 75 grand a year would retire. I was expecting a holy crap moment. And, you know, and it didn't happen. And I mean, that's a comment, I suppose, firstly, and perhaps with better modelling where you do actually include more of issues associated with the litigation and the loss of licence to operate, you'll see a change in those numbers. I guess my question, and perhaps an interesting opportunity here, is this area of pricing in. You spoke about this Minsky moment, Sharanjit. How do we learn from other jurisdictions that might be doing a better job, perhaps, of heightening levels of transparency so that, you know, consumer investors can understand, you know, who has priced in and who hasn't. So that perhaps we might actually get more of investment activity reflecting climate risk.
I'll just say one thing in an attempt to be more attention grabbing. So maybe if you multiply the impacts by 25 million on a population-wide basis, the numbers get bigger quite quickly. And also if you look at the present value per person of the additional amount the government has to spend on age pension to effectively hedge the loss in earnings that may result from these scenarios, it's $20,000 to $30,000 per person in current dollar terms. So, you know,
if only we've had that number before the election.
Yeah, and the fact is that will come from taxation. So in fact, it's people's kids who are going to be paying to make up the number of their retirement. And, you know, the money isn't appearing magically. It's just we have this system whereby current workers are taxed for retired people. Yeah, and so if only we'd known that this is the 20 to 30,000 additional taxes we'll be paying for the elderly. So I guess that's another piece to that.
So it is a combination of being clear about, you know, we've done it, others are doing it, that we do what we can with the models, with the data that we have available at the moment, and particularly on the environmental side. So there's both the climate models and all the feedback loops that they don't capture at the moment. That may change with the next IPCC working group as the consensus closes on the physical damages side. And as we get better environmental data, we can plug those into the existing models, and I think that physical damages side will start to come through, and then you'll start to see what the implications are. Because the aha moment is really on the physical damages side. On the transition side, we need to look at this as a positive. So the fact that I'm not telling you it's going to cost you an absolute bomb to transition, this is the good news. So it is very. There are going to be some sectors, absolutely, they will be worth nothing. There will be stranded assets. There will be some sectors, absolutely, there will be some companies that will not be around. But there are many, many other opportunities to focus on. So that transition piece, the fact that we can transition, we have the investment capital, we have the technology, we have the ability to transition, take that as the good news. That means it is possible for us to avoid the worst potential that could be coming that's not modelled. So there's a bit of a mix in there. Agreed that, you know, but even if I scared you with what is the number that would make everyone scared enough to do something? What is that number? We can come up with some model that says that number. That's actually not going to be the answer, but maybe your number might get our government to do something. Maybe that's the number. You've got the answer.
Richard.
Richard Lyon. I don't have a number, but what I do have is an observation that next year another intergenerational report is due. And now would be not too soon to be lobbying Treasury that there should be climate scenarios in that IGR.
I agree.
Is that your action?
Sorry?
Is that your action?
Is that my action? I'll certainly think it's something we could contribute as the Institute and look into. Yeah. I mean, it was a big disappointment in the 2015 IGR, quite how poorly the climate transition was done, and certainly the Institute at that time contributed some comments about that. Yeah. Okay, I'm conscious of time. Unless there are any burning questions, I'd just very much like to thank you for coming here today. And again, the invitation to join the Climate Change Working Group. We're definitely going to be looking at life insurance. One of the things that we've got slated next year is to think about the requirement for appointed actuaries in FCRs to talk about risks facing organizations, and perhaps putting out an information note on how appointed actuaries might think about climate risks to and discuss those within FCRs, just to give you a very actuarial kind of action point on this. But thank you once again.